right. Friday, 5 p.m. Time for American Hit Radio. WHPC 90.3 FM. I'm glad to be in a nice air-conditioned studio right now.
For a change.
I'm Tom Ryan, my lovely wife, co-host, and extraordinary engineer Heidi Morales-Ryan here as well. I'm with you for the next hour. We're always, as always, between 5 and 6 p.m. on Wednesdays and Fridays. We started a new series for our How Music Changed series of shows just last Friday. We did show number one for a series of shows, which is going to be dedicated to the Gershwins. And I'm looking forward to this series. The first episode, usually a bit chatty in the beginning.
Well, you got to give them the history.
Got to catch up with what was what. Right. I mean, an awful lot goes on before they get to their first recording. So we have to cover the backstory, so to speak. But speaking of backstory, that's what this actually is about. We are back in the early 20s at this point in time. In fact, the show that we just did ended circa around 1921, 22. The last song that we played for last week's show was Swanee. I don't know if you recall this, but what made Swanee interesting was that it came out of George Gershwin's tenure as a Tin Pan Alley songwriter. And it was also marked the end of his tenure as a Tin Pan Alley writer. From this point forward, he had become interested in trying to write for shows. He just thought that there was a bit more artistic, would be more of a challenge, and something that he would like to do. Also, at this point in time, he is not writing with any regularity with his brother Ira. They've got separate careers. Ira was admittedly a little bit like jealous, in a sense, of George's remarkable success, but he loved his brother. He couldn't believe how easily things came to him. And Ira was a lot more laid back. He was a wordsmith and doing fine with that and just basically waiting to see what happened. So we pretty much pick up where they are more or less having their own, you know, respective careers at this point in time. So in quick order, George did find himself writing music for Broadway shows, with his brother Ira occasionally providing lyrics for some of his compositions, but it took some time for the two brothers to recognize that their talents were intrinsically suited to one another. In the early 20s, the whole, you know, the musical form for a Broadway-style show was still a fairly new concept, and the exacting demand for detailed perfection that the brothers both had aided them in their role of developing the form. And as if that weren't enough, George also began to set himself the task of developing the means to bring jazz and serious music together. So that's going to be the concept for this show in general. George's friends, meanwhile, were very excited about the fact that he had suddenly got a big hit with the song Swanee. I'll be reading occasionally from a book called Fascinating Rhythm, the collaboration of George and Ira Gershwin. It's written by Dina Rosenberg. Very useful. Skipping throughout the text to keep the story. I'm not going to read the entire book, obviously, just to keep the story moving along. Now, George and his circle of friends talked constantly about the artistic scene and went together to shows, films, and concerts, and sometimes out to eat. No one had too much money at that point. On occasion, one or another of George's inner group found themselves arguing with highbrow acquaintances who they felt did not take George seriously enough. So that's rather interesting. George was basically considered a lowbrow pop songwriter.
Oh, dear.
But in 1921, incredible how long ago this was, George and Ira wrote their first show together. A Dangerous Mind had several good songs, especially one called Boy Wanted, which was used again in the London hit Primrose 3 years later. But the show died on the road before reaching New York. By 1924, George would write the music to 125 songs we know of, and perhaps more that are lost, and Ira the lyrics to at least 40 of them. Yet the brothers collaborated on only 18 of all of those songs. The Gershwins enjoyed writing together, but as yet there were no fireworks. Let's hear that track that George had written for the show, Primrose and Dangerous Mind, called Boy Wanted. Here it is as performed by pretty much one, our hero of this series is most certainly going to be Ella Fitzgerald.
Thank you. I've just finished writing an advertisement calling for a boy. No half-hearted Romeo or flirt is meant. That's the kind I'd not employ. Though anybody interested can apply, he must know a thing or two to qualify. For instance, he must be able to dance. He must make life a romance. I said a boy wanted one who can smile. Boy wanted lovable style. He must know how to say yes. When I look at like musical shows, and he must wear snappy clothes. Yes, that is my story, and to it I'll stick. No glory in having a hick. Such a saint, but oh, he dasn't say ain't. I don't care if his bankroll totals not, for we can live on love and food for thought. If he's a scholar, when I see him, I'll holler, my lad, I'm glad you answered my
There are hundreds, if not thousands, of people who have interpreted Gershwin's music, but few really ever did it as well as Ella Fitzgerald did.
No one can come close to her.
She's something else. And you know, if there's, she did in the latter part of her career, she did the songbooks, a series of albums, where each release was dedicated to a different great American songwriter, and they are fabulous pieces of work, incredible. She did a huge collection of albums dedicated to Duke Ellington, Cole Porter, I believe Jerome Kern, and of course a triple album that she did dedicated to the Gershwins.
Do you know the titles of them?
Well, that's just the Ella Fitzgerald songbooks.
Oh.
You know, sings the songs of. It's just a series. They all came together in a very beautiful Lushbox set for a while. I remember when I bought that, I was very, very happy about 15 years ago when I got that.
I remember.
Anyway, as we said, George had yet to develop a distinctive musical style of his own at this point, one that also could draw distinctive lyrics from Ira. For a time, in fact, George's intent was to emulate others. "I learned to write music," he once recollected, "by studying the most successful songs published. At 19, I could write a song that sounded so much like Jerome Kern that he wouldn't know whether he or I had written it." The whimsical kind of ballad, that lyric that Ira was later to write, remained in the future until George's musical language became his own. George, looking back on this time, recalled, "As I had a searching mind, ordinary harmonies, rhythms, sequences, intervals, and so on failed to satisfy my ear. I would spend hour upon hour trying to change them around so that they would satisfy me. After a patient apprenticeship at this, I began developing along more original lines." This happened decisively in 1922 with two songs, Do It Again and Stairway to Paradise, and a 20-minute opera called Blue Monday. Do It Again remained one of George's favorites throughout his life. The song begins with a musical technique that was fast becoming a Gershwin trademark, starting a song with a striking melodic fragment and then repeating it with a different and unexpected harmony underneath. As George would say to an interviewer in 1924, "I think of melody as a line, a single thread, as the body of music and the harmony as the clothes you put on it. I can take a melody and harmonize it 1,000 different ways. The effect in Do It Again is to deepen and heighten the simultaneously seductive and yearning intent of the lyric." Let's play that song. Here it is. Actually, a rather remarkable rendition of it from the album Live at Carnegie Hall. Here's Judy Garland.
"You really shouldn't have done it. You hadn't any right. I really shouldn't have let you kiss me. And although it was wrong, I never was strong. So as long as you've begun it, and you know you shouldn't have done it. Oh, do it again. I may cry just ache to have you take the kiss that's waiting for you. You know if you do, you won't regret it. Scold me, 'cause she told me it was naughty, but then please do it again. Yes, do it again and again. And again, in your arms all through the night. I know tomorrow morning you will say, please do it
again. Go with the late great Judy Garland. I think George would have been very happy with that arrangement of his song called Do It Again that she had performed live at Carnegie Hall. Very popular album, I believe, from the late 50s when it came out. There's another emerging Gershwin-esque technique used to good effect in that song, is the as the book here says, is the skillful pivoting between the major key of the song and its relative minor key, giving the insouciance, even brashness, of Buddy De Silva's lyric a poignant subtext, which is to say that if you were just going to read the words, it could have been like a regular jazz number and it might have been like almost funny or goofy. But with George doing what he did musically, it makes the song seem as though it's actually the lyrics seem a little bit heavier in their intent. And it's good writing. There are many ways to make major minor equivocation happen. In another song we'll be playing in a short bit, Stairway to Paradise, with lyrics by Ira with Buddy De Silva together, and Blue Monday, which has a libretto by De Silva, George used a device known as the blue note, something that was very new to popular music in the early 20s. He did so to such dramatic effect that it resulted in his best work to date. George's use of blue notes added a dimension to his theater songs that attracted Ira deeply. He soon began to find his own style of words to go with it. Blue notes are tones that are injected into music in major keys to give the music a provocative, sometimes melancholy or minor tinge. Originally, blue notes were a convention of blues singing, wherein the singers would bend the notes to get pitches between those in the Western scale. Soon, though, composers wanted to write this effect down and began to approximate it by writing that they would flatten the third or the seventh note of the major scale. Now, a blue note can be placed in the melody or in the harmony that accompanies it. When used strategically, unexpectedly, it gives a song an additional dimension or a subtext, a coloration that may imply paradox, satire, poignance, ambivalence, and or the coexistence of opposites. It's exactly like what George was saying earlier when he said that he would play the same thing over and over again and try to find something that would make him hear it differently, that would spark him to enjoy it, which was by playing these notes that were technically not in the scale, it basically colorized everything else that was around it and even changed the meaning of the words in a sense when you did that, or certainly the mood of the piece. Some noted music and cultural historians suggest that blue notes came into the American music vernacular from two sources: the African-American blues, of course, but also Jewish liturgical music. By 1922, George and Ira had heard much of both kinds of music. Up to then, blue notes had occurred frequently in folk and religious music, the blues, and the emerging genre soon to be known as jazz. George was well acquainted with W.C. Handy's St. Louis Blues and other works. But Blue Notes had yet to be used extensively or notably in American theater song. In Blue Monday and Stairway, George put Blue Notes on Broadway, using them to express a character's conflicting feelings within a given song. Blue Monday, later retitled 135th Street, is set in a Harlem saloon on 135th Street and Lenox Avenue. The nightlife of Harlem in the 20s centered around 135th Street. Written for the George White's Scandals of 1922, it is about two lovers who destroy each other through distrust, jealousy, and pride. Because it was too downbeat for the otherwise upbeat review, it was cut from the show after one performance. But there is much good music in Blue Monday, especially the title song, Blue Monday Blues, which begins lazily, humorously, in major, but immediately is tinged by a Blue Notes wail. George, who spent a lot of time in Harlem nights listening to the music, had the people he was writing about in his eyes and ears. While the libretto, is a bit simplistic and dated, the music by itself is still dramatically suggestive. Let's hear this early interesting piece where George Gershwin actually begins to incorporate Blue Notes. Here is Gershwin himself performing Blue Monday or 135th Street Blues.
Rarity.
Colored saloon, and there you will see a tragedy. Enacted in operatic style, and like the white man's opera, the theme will be love, hate, passion.
Thank you.
but you. But after all, I'm only human, and I'm a mighty jealous woman. And still, just as long as
nothing else there, you can hear the ambition of George Gershwin plainly at work, writing a long piece, over 6 minutes, incorporating blue notes. I said that was credit to George Gershwin. I mean, that's because he's the writer. I should have mentioned that was actually taken from...
I took that the wrong way.
Yeah, it's definitely not him singing. He's the writer, but that was basically taken from a movie that incorporated that piece of music, the film Girl Crazy, I believe. Is what had used that. Let me remind you, you're listening to WHPC 90.3. The show is American Hit Radio. I'm your host, Tom Ryan. With Heidi Morales Ryan, we do this every Wednesday and Friday from 5 until 6 p.m. On Wednesday, we call the show basically American Hit Radio because we just basically we feature albums mostly. Alternative Top 500 and Top 500 of the Top 40, basically great albums from history, playing them in chronological order. If you tune in on a Wednesday, you're likely to be hearing us playing an album at this point from the latter part of 1968, because that's where we are with our count up, so to speak, chronological count up. This show on Friday, of course, the How Music Changed series, we have 250 topics that we try to cover in depth. This is a new one for us. As of last week, we're covering the music of the Gershwins. We'll cover their career up until George's death. And this is show number two. And I look forward to basically moving through this series as I've always found their music fascinating to me. And this basically brings it to life for me. So I'm looking forward to that. I should mention that all of our shows also are saved on our website. So if you're interested, check out AmericanHitNetwork.com or just search for American Hit Radio, our show, and of course it will come right up and you'll see the homepage. On that homepage, you'll see four channels, essentially. One channel is for the top 500 of the top 40, all the albums that we are covering, and they're listed there in numerical order to make it very obvious. So you can actually count along with us, so to speak, and see what we're coming up with. You might even, if you're interested, compare it to what you might have been picking yourselves. The same thing with the second channel, which is the alternative top 40. We're picking albums that never made the top 40. We're playing them in chronological order as they managed to come up through as we move through time. And they're all posted. There's a third channel, which is basically when we have live artists and when we do some unusual other shows that don't fit into our normal programming. That would be the fourth channel, and of course, the third channel. And the fourth channel, of course, is this show, How Music Changed, where we are going to try to get all of those shows posted. So far, we have got, this must be 500 of them, because we've done so many. We've been doing this for close to 10 years, this How Music Changed series. And we've only covered so far about maybe 58 of our 250 topics. So I'm going to have to figure out some way to basically get an injection and live to the year 230.
Oh, good luck with that.
I got to finish this. So check it out. That's AmericanHitNetwork.com. I should also mention this on a personal note. This is just because this is something that's coming up. If you're interested, if you're a regular listener, you know that Heidi and I are a part of something called the New York Roots Music Association. It's an organization of incredibly talented musicians. I'm very proud to be a member.
It's a social aid and pleasure club.
Yes, and Saturday night social aid and pleasure club part of it. It's a very long name. We can just go by the New York Roots Music Association, otherwise known as NYRMA, N-Y-R-M-A. And we've been putting on shows now for about 7 years. And these shows have been quite remarkable. Lately, they sell out very easily, very quickly. And next Saturday, July 29th, there's going to be a very special NYRMA event. It's actually taking place at our own house in our backyard, where we are going to be featuring 8 musical acts all day long from 1 o'clock in the afternoon until 10 p.m. that night. 9 hours of live music. 8 artists.
Very ambitious.
We're out of our minds. And in the middle of that, there will be a New York Roots Music Association performance. We will be doing a tribute to the band Big Star. And if you were listening to our series before the Gershwins, which was when we were doing Memphis to Muscle Shoals, you might be familiar with Big Star because we played a few of their songs toward the end of that series. Anyway, Alex Chilton as well. So it's been a huge amount of work, but fun work to put all of this together. And if you'd like to join us, you can. You can come. You're more than welcome to, if you're interested in coming, on Facebook, just look up, find a friend or whatever that is, or find a person. Type in New York Roots Music Association, and our page comes up. What?
Yeah, you're so unfamiliar with how
Facebook works. I know. It's really painful. I'm not on it often.
It humors me.
To be honest, I'm there when I need to be, but I try to get other people to help me with it because I get very confused with what happens on Facebook. But anyway, if you're interested, please.
A quick search will help you find it on Facebook.
Yeah. But don't type in NYRMA. I don't know if that works. I think you've got to type in the full long name, New York Roots Music Association.
Right.
And you'll see all the details about the party on Saturday. It's going to be a piece of work. Oh, we even are lucky enough. We're going to have a national performer with us. Kevin Gordon is coming up from Nashville. He'll be one of the players at the NYRMA event on July 29. This takes place, by the way, in East Northport. So for the details and all of the other stuff that you're going to need to know, please, as I said, check out on Facebook the New York Roots Music Association page, and you'll see what you need. All right, back to Gershwin then. Pardon the commercial.
It's not a commercial.
Right. That song, Blue Monday, was orchestrated by Will Votary, a black arranger who is one of George's early supporters and friends in the music business, and conducted in the Scandals by an emerging popular band leader named Paul Whiteman, leading an unusually good pit orchestra. At the time, a perceptive few noted with interest Blue Monday's brief life on stage, among them Ira and Whiteman. One critic described it as the first real American opera. In it, we see the first gleam of a new American musical art. Another wrote, "This opera will be imitated in 100 years. Blue Monday was George's most ambitious work yet, and, in Ira's words, contained intimations of the musical paths that George was later to follow, especially in terms of what George described as blue recitative. Stairway to Paradise, on the other hand, was the show's biggest hit. According to Ira, bands around town and some record companies played up Stairway to Paradise more than anything else in the show, and it became a hit. That is, for a review. Most hit songs from the stage emerge from musicals rather than reviews. My one-third of Stairway's royalties amounted to $3,500, said Ira, enough to support me for a year.
Wow.
As I said, keep in mind that at this point, he was sharing writing credits with Buddy De Silva. The Scandals, where it was used, opened on August 28, 1922, and Stairway to Paradise was its high point, with chorus girls, orchestra, lavish costumes and sets, the whole glittering works. George described it this way. Two circular staircases surrounded the orchestra on the stage, leading high up into the theatrical paradise, or the flies, which in everyday language means the ceiling. Mr. White had draped 50 of his most beautiful girls in a black patent leather material, which brilliantly reflected the spotlights. A dance was staged in the song, and those girls didn't need much coaxing to do their stuff to the accompaniment of Whiteman's music. Here is the song, I'll Build a Stairway to Paradise, a later version, though, as performed by Miss Sarah Vaughan.
I do love Sarah Vaughan.
All you preachers who delight in panning the dancing teachers, let me tell you there are a lot of features of the dance that carry you through the gates of heaven. It's madness to be always sitting around in sadness when you could be learning the steps of gladness. You'll be happy when you can do just six or seven. Begin today, you'll find it nice, the quickest way to paradise. When you practice, here's the thing to do, simply say as you go, I'll build a stairway to paradise with a new step every day. I'm going to get there at any price. Stand aside, I'm on my way. I've got the blues, and up above it's so fair. Shoes, go on and carry me there. I'll build a stairway to paradise.
Vaughn.
She's got a great voice.
Stairway to Paradise. Around this time, this is pretty interesting, but there was a critic named Gilbert Seldes who wrote, basically hearing these songs by George and developing a very interesting early opinion. They understand, as you can see, this is still very early in George's career. This, you've heard the highlights of it in the past two shows. And yeah, there's so far been, you know, Boy Wanted, Do It Again, Swanee, you know. But this is Seldes' opinion. Two composers are possible successors to Irving Berlin if he ever chooses to stop. I am sure of Gershwin and would be more sure of Cole Porter if his astonishing lyrics did not so dazzle me as to make me distrust my estimate of his music. Gershwin's is in Berlin's tradition. He has almost all the older man's qualities as a composer, not as a lyric writer, nor has he Berlin's sense of a song on the stage. But that is to say, Gershwin is capable of everything from Swanee to A Stairway to Paradise. His sentiment is gentler than Berlin's, his attack more delicate. Delicacy, even dreaminess, is a quality he alone brings into jazz music. And his sense of variation and rhythm, of an oddly placed accent, of emphasis and color, is impeccable. He isn't of the stage yet, so he lacks Berlin's occasional bright hardness. He never has Berlin's smartness. And he seems possessed of an insatiable interest and curiosity. I feel I can bank on him. Around that time, a friend named Alex Ahrens wrote to Ira about his plans for the following year, thinking, again, talking about George. For Goodness Sake, the name of a show, now called Stop Flirting, has made quite a big hit on tour here, and the Astaires have scored a tremendous success. A lot of managers, agents, etc., both here and in America, are trying to sign them up, and I am sure their success here will greatly enhance their value in America. Therefore, I believe you will be pleased to know that I have just put them under contract to be in a new musical comedy under my management in America, immediately following their closing in Stop Flirting in London. I have not found the right book for them yet, but I'm going to devote a great amount of my time from now on looking for it. I have always had the greatest amount of faith in these two, and since I have seen what they can do to the audience here, I am convinced that I have secured one of the most valuable pieces of property, as far as talent is concerned, on the American musical comedy stage. As George has probably told you, I am planning to have him do the score alone. In fact, Ahrens was banking on more than George and the Astaires. His letter to Ira continues, "I believe you know that there is no one I should like so much for the lyrics as you. I feel that this will be just the kind of thing we have all been wanting to do for a long time." On January 3rd, Ira Gershwin, just 27, informed his brother of yet another commitment of an entirely different sort, one that caught George unawares. Late that evening, as George and Da Silva played pool, Ira was reading the entertainment section of the Herald Tribune. He was surprised to see an announcement for, quote, "an experiment in modern music," a concert to be performed by Paul Whiteman and his Palais Royal Orchestra on February 12th at Aeolian Hall. The concert was meant to determine the nature, direction, and value of American popular music written over the past 10 years. To this end, leading classical musicians and critics would be asked to serve as judges. Further, reported the Tribune, Whiteman had commissioned compositions for the occasion from Victor Herbert and Irving Berlin, plus a jazz concerto by George Gershwin. The newspaper article, Ira later wrote, was the first inkling that George had that Whiteman was serious when he once casually mentioned that someday he expected to do such a concert and hoped for a contribution from George. He had no idea that it was happening until they read it in the paper, in other words.
Surprise.
Whiteman called his group a jazz band, but it was actually an exceptionally good dance and popular concert band. In the early 20s, the definition of the term jazz was still evolving. However, no one then or since has doubted the quality of Whiteman's musicians and arrangers. In 1923, Gilbert Seldes wrote that Whiteman and his band, quote, "had arrived at one high point, the highest, until new material in the music is provided for him." Whiteman thought that George was the composer to provide that better music. A trained violinist with a solid classical background, Whiteman had conducted the 1922 George White Scandals and had responded strongly to Blue Monday and Stairway to Paradise, to George's ability to synthesize vocabularies and reach diverse audiences. He was also impressed by George's distinctive piano playing. George saw Whiteman's commission in early 1924 as the chance to take his own next musical step. He met the challenge with a work that drew heavily on the popular sphere to achieve serious ends. At first, George, quote, "had no set plan, no structure to which my music must conform." He gave himself one definite task, to compose a piece with enough rhythmic variety to disprove the prevalent notion that any composition played by a popular band, even a good one like Whiteman's, had to be in strict time with a steady, repetitive dance rhythm throughout the piece. Instead, George envisioned a work with freer and more diversified rhythms. Rather than a concerto, George decided on a looser form, a rhapsody. Ira later recalled that his brother had long been impressed by the 2-octave-plus glissando that Russ Gorman, Whiteman's clarinetist, could draw from his instrument. Before Gorman, such a long slide was thought to be technically impossible. Gorman not only played it effortlessly, but in such a way as to make the clarinet sound as if it were laughing or mocking itself. According to Dick Hyman, Gordon's sound was very much in the East European Jewish klezmer tradition. Ira recalled that George had notated the glissando in one of his theme books for possible future use and instantly thought of it as an opening for this new work of his. George was so pressed for time that he left several piano solo spots for himself to improvise at the work's premiere. Whiteman's score that night had several blank pages, ending with the words, "Wait for nod," from George, before he was to cue in the orchestra. George's writing process was, and would remain, largely improvisational. Though once he got what he wanted, he carefully notated it. Each section of the piece seems to flow naturally out of the one before, propelling the piece from the first note to the last. The result? An extended work with thematic development, sharp contrasts, melodic ingenuity, and sophisticated harmonies and rhythms composed with a new vocabulary drawn largely from American sources. At first, George thought he would call his new work American Fantasy or American Rhapsody. It was Ira who suggested Rhapsody in Blue. Rhapsody connotes the European classical music tradition. In Blue, pulls it into contemporary America. The choice of the title reveals Ira's deep sensitivity to George's use of blue notes. Ira had discovered, in Ira Goldberg's phrase, the very psychology of the music. Despite what their diverse ethnic origins, the Americans of the 20s, whom George evoked in Rhapsody in Blue, shared a new, distinctively American musical voice, one about to be applauded around the world for swinging rhythms that beat around the bar line, provocative harmonies that seemed loath to resolve, and especially the blue note-centered melodies and major-minor harmonies. It is suggestive to hear blue notes with their black Jewish derivation as the collective cry of long-oppressed peoples. But depending on context, equivocation around a blue note can imply more than sadness. It can also provide an insouciant, bold, and seductive flavor, sometimes simultaneously. Believe it or not, we have a recording that George made with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra, a very early version of Rhapsody in Blue. It's 10 minutes long, so that's going to fill out the rest of our show. Hope you enjoy hearing this very early, like I said, very early, and as it turns out, much shorter than the version that we've all come to know, as the longer version is generally closer to 15 or 16 minutes. But here it is then, as it was recorded in the 20s with Paul Whiteman's orchestra and George Gershwin. Take care, everybody. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Wah, wah, wah.